Ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to welcome to the Solaria Report Don Cox, who's joined us several times before. He's the CEO of Cox Advisor LLC and strategist advisor to the Cox Commodity Strategy Fund and Cox Global Agribusiness Income Fund in Canada. He is often described as a Renaissance man, and that's appropriate because his understanding of the financial system and the entire economy is phenomenal. He can speak at a global level and take you right down to harvesting a crop at a farm and back up to the global financial system. And there's really nobody I know who understands the whole politics and the economics, the whole thing, and can also take you back in history. So, Don, thank you very much for taking time out of what's been a very busy schedule to join us on the Solaria Report.
My pleasure.
Well, negative interest rates. We've been watching markets, interest rates go negative around the world. And, of course, the question is, are they going to come to the United States? So I'd love to hear what you have to say about what's happening and where you think it's going.
We talked about them the last time you and I were chatting. And I took the view that this was a sign that the central bankers were running out of games to play to try to get the economy moving. And that this was a truly radical step, because when you create negative yields, the old argument against bonds used to be, well, you know, you lose out on inflation with them, or they've got very low yields, so you need to be investing in stocks to avoid the fact that you get low returns on bonds. But it never occurred to anybody that governments could issue negative yield bonds in which you put down your money and deliberately plan to lose money on it. And when we talked before, there were $2 trillion of negative yield bonds outstanding, and I was expressing scorn about this and saying that this was going to be a sign that there was going to be trouble ahead for the bond market. We're up to $9 trillion now of negative yield bonds in the world, government bonds. And now we've even had the vice chairman of the Federal Reserve expressing admiration for what he calls the success in Europe of the negative yielding bonds. So all I can say about the negative yielding bonds is that the people who really had to take charge of saving the world when we had the Wall Street crash are obviously scared about the global economy. And so they are trying to drive yields down to a level that's sort of irresistible for people to take risks. And the fact that they've gone to negative yields is a sign of how worried they are about the economies of their own countries. Mostly this is in the Eurozone, but the fact that the Fed even suggests the possibility of negative yields helps explain why it is that the Fed shocked us this week, or shocked most people this week, by announcing that instead of having 4 increases in rates this year, that we may have only 2, and even that is no longer a certainty. In other words, that since the time that people were putting the ornaments on their Christmas trees in December, that the outlook has become much more of concern to the people at the Fed, so that only one member of the Open Market Committee voted for doing what everybody had told us before was almost inevitable. So the negative
I should tell you, we voted Esther George the hero of the week on the Solaria Report last night.
Yes, good for Esther George. I had the same attitude, which is she's a smart, sensible lady, And smart, sensible ladies don't tend to get overwhelmed by abstract theories from PhD economists of things that have never existed before, and therefore saying, well, if they never existed before, why don't we try using them now? If you're trying to save a patient with a new drug, that's one thing, and say, well, we haven't tried this drug before, but we're going to try it now. But to suggest that you're going to have financial instruments where the buyer automatically is there to lose money on the transaction and say that the benefits to the old economy from that, that's quite a sense. So Esther George was basically saying, I'm a nice Midwest lady. I've grown up here. I know something about two and two making four, and I am sticking with the program. So I think we can put paid to that and maybe get on to another topic, which might be of more interest than the abstract question of negative yields. Talk about what's happening to oil prices.
Oh, I would love to. So, yes, that was the initial impetus. We've had quite a drop at the beginning of this year, you know, on top of last year and the year before, and now oil's come back a bit. So please tell us what you think has been going on and where you think this goes.
Okay. Well, since you've been following our work, you know that in October of 14, we told our listeners and followers that the Saudis and their allies were going to drive oil prices down because the U.S. government was discussing the idea of letting Iran come in from the cold, and that Iran would be allowed to get on track to produce a nuclear weapon. And what I explained then, and have repeated, perhaps ad nauseum, this conversation that I participated in 6 years ago with Prince Turki, who was at that time an ambassador, T-U-R-K-I. He became head of security in Riyadh. And the reason I was able to talk about it was because it had been a gathering of only six gentlemen. It was his last night in the U.S. and was arranged for a mutual friend. And I was sworn to secrecy about that conversation. But he had done an interview on U.S. television, which got attracted almost no attention, saying that this was exactly what they were going to have to do, that the only mechanism they had was to drive down oil prices because Iran has the second or third largest reserves of oil in the world, and they haven't been making much money out of them because they haven't been able to get the technology and access to the markets. But they were going to be able to get all this plus the right to develop a nuclear bomb if Obama went along with this. So they said the only thing they could do was to drive down oil prices. And that's exactly what they've done. And it's cost them and their allies about $250 billion to date. But at the dinner, when we were discussing a Mideast situation, and this is 6 years ago, naturally the subject of Israel came up. And what the prince said was, yes, that is a problem in the Middle East, but that's not the big problem. The big problem is that Iran may be able to get the bomb. And he said, that must not happen. And then he slammed his fist on the table. That must not happen. He said, if Iran gets the bomb, given the radical regime that they have, then all the other major states in the Middle East will have to get the bomb. And given the fragility of Middle East politics, that means there will be a nuclear war. So, the only way that can be prevented is if the United States refuses to let Iran participate in the global economy and must forswear any idea of getting the nuclear bomb. And so no surprise then that after that, Benjamin Netanyahu came and spoke in Congress, for which he was denounced by the president. And he basically outlined the same theory. By that time, it was becoming quite apparent that Saudi Arabia and the Emirates and the Israeli government were becoming very friendly indeed for the first time in history.
Right.
And so, because both of them feared Iran more than anything else in the world. So, what we've seen is they've stuck to this. They've just kept on pumping out more oil. Now, the question is, all of a sudden, oil prices are rallying. So, the question before us is, have the Saudis and the Emirates and their allies taken so much pain and with no results that they will decide, well, okay, they're going to have to rein in their production? Because there's no question that their economies have been devastated by this. There's no question that their OPEC allies have been devastated. Now, you may say, wait a minute, all that was done is to attack American frackers. What's this about the Iran getting the bomb? That was what they said they were thinking about trying to do when they were talking to countries like Venezuela and Nigeria, who weren't the least bit interested in worrying about a Mideast war. So that was the excuse that they used, which was American frackers driving down the price of oil. So, and obviously they would be pleased to be able to drive a lot of the American frackers out of business. But that is what you're talking about, is the difference between what you think would be a nice, pleasant market circumstance and what you believe is absolute survival for your civilization. And remember, there was once again troubles at the Mecca last year. And this time Iran said, we demand the right to share the control of Mecca with the Saudis because we believe our Shia penitents were badly treated compared with the Sunnis. This is the core of what gives Saudi Arabia its legitimacy, is that they control Mecca and Medina. And that they have that as their sacred cause. And when you talk to them, when they talk about what their priorities are as rulers, that's at the top of the list. We are the custodians of the sacred shrines. So what the problem then is suddenly now it looks as if oil prices have bottomed out and are coming back. Does this mean that they've decided that the pain is too great for themselves, and therefore we're going to let oil prices go back up? Because when you look at the charts, what you see is since the October of 14, oil prices have fallen from $120 down to as low as $29. Devastating. And but it shows you what is possible when the supply and demand are in close balance. So therefore, the fact of their all-out production of 10 to 11 million barrels a day was enough to drive oil prices down. So have they given up on this? And if they have, are they going to cut their production by 1.5 million barrels a day? And if they do that, we'll see $60 and $70 oil again. And
right.
So the answer to that is, I don't know.
Right.
But all the discussion that you're seeing out there tends to talk about, well, how much is being done by frackers, and are there missing barrels of oil here and there? All of that is of interest only to those who are short-term traders.
Right.
For your clients and everybody, what they need, all they need to think about is, have the Sunnis decided they've got to cave in on Iran?
Right. And so here's my question, Don. Why did Obama and Kerry, because I don't believe they're in control, but why did the U.S. government do the deal?
Well,
why do you think?
Oh, because Mr. Obama was of the view that the only way there was going to be peace in the Middle East was to make Iran part of the solution. And Mr. Obama has made it clear with his interview with The Atlantic that he is now, we now have U.S. politics with the two biggest egotists. One is the president who's retiring, and one is the man who wants to be president. And what Obama has made clear in his interviews with The Atlantic is that he's always been the smartest man in the room, that he was always given bad advice by the so-called experts, and that that's why things went wrong. And the deal with Iran is his way of making sure that there will eventually be peace in the Middle East, because bringing Iran into the solution of the problem is the only way to eventually solve the problem. And that had to be done, and that's why he was prepared to go to the lengths that he did. And he believes that he knows the correct answer to what the problems of peace are in the Middle East. So he's been very frank about that, and he's backed it up in his interview with The Atlantic. So at all times, he was of the view that there would be no chance of peace in the Middle East as long as Iran was isolated. And Iran had to be given this opportunity, and he believed that Iran would not go ahead with the bomb then. And then when they proceeded to set off three ICBMs, which were specifically forbidden in all the discussions, and when the Republicans in the Senate said, well, in that case, we undo the deal, they said, oh, no, 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 that was never part of the deal. There was only a side agreement that they would not go to work on creating ICBMs. So they said, what we've done is we moved to the UN Security Council. We've got a resolution condemning them for having done this. That's probably the 112th resolution of the UN Security Council condemning Iran for bad behavior. So the answer is that what we have is a president absolutely committed to having Iran able to stand up. And, of course, one of the reasons he feels that way is because he can see that these radical groups that are killing people at the moment are nearly all Sunni groups, whether they're one group or another, they are Sunnis. The only radical Shia group is the one that operates in Syria. And so they're the ones that blew up the U.S. Marine base back when Reagan was president. So the President Obama's viewpoint can be justified on the basis of saying ISIS and Al-Qaeda, these radical groups, are Sunnis, and one way or the other, the Saudis have managed to either back them or help spawn them. So what we need in order to control this is to bring in a new group of tough guys, Shias, who we think are very smart, and maybe they can finally bring peace to the Middle East. It's a good theory. A lot is riding on it.
Right. Well, let's talk about some of the other commodities. You know a lot about the agricultural commodities, and one of the things we see across the United States, we're seeing it now in two areas. One is coal, but one in agriculture. These prices are, of course, devastating the coal industry, but also the agricultural commodities are devastating and wiping out a lot of the remaining small and mid-sized farmers. So it's a big question in those sectors, what's going to happen next?
Well, the coal industry is never had a chance once you got the United Nations passing that resolution that says that the biggest threat to the world's survival is global warming through carbon dioxide. It was only a matter of time before the coal industry in the United States would be virtually shut down. And when President Obama made this his number one foreign policy objective, it was quite obvious, therefore, that the Environmental Protection Administration was going to create rules for the use of coal and burning to generate energy, which would be impossible for utilities once we got low prices for natural gas. And so the irony is that the extreme success of fracking for nat gas gave the Obama administration the opening it wanted to improve. And as a matter of fact, the United States had the best progress in lowering carbon output in the last 4 years of any of the signatories to that. And that's because of shutting down coal burning plants. So it came out, and this is widely supported. There's, unless you live in Kentucky and places like that, you say, well, we don't want dirty energy. So that's why there was never any plot in this. That was their policy right through it. And it's devastating. The idea that Peabody Coal, which is already in bankruptcy, may shut down for good. Peabody Coal was a gigantic company long before either you or I were born, and was a worldwide respected company. Amazing to think that it's going to disappear.
Right. And we saw, I think it was in 2015, we literally saw those stocks come down 70 to 90% in 1 year of the top four coal companies.
Yeah, I remember attending a board meeting for the second biggest coal company, and it went into bankruptcy last year. And at that time, its stock price was about $65 a share. And that board meeting was about 6 years ago. In other words, we're talking about very recent history where these companies were gigantic companies, and they're gone. Right. So that is the biggest effect of the priority of this government on fighting global warming. And in this case, there's just not much chance of the Republicans doing anything to protect them, because the success of fracking, lower nat gas. Remember, at the time of Katrina, nat gas prices got up to $14 a thousand cubic feet, and now they're infinitesimally small. Nobody, they are cheaper than coal, and of course, you don't have to build massive scrubbers to deal with them. So this is a case in which the success of fracking backed up already a government policy. So the coal industry in the United States, meanwhile, the coal industry elsewhere in the rest of the world is doing just fine, thank you, because they're most worrying about for decades ahead. They don't have all that cheap nat gas.
Right. Agriculture.
Well,
can we touch on?
Yeah, what we've got here is a situation where, once again, nothing succeeds like success. And when you got to the stage where more than 90% of the corn that was being produced was genetically modified, which meant that, therefore, the output per acre would keep expanding year to year, and that they would be able to deal with any climate changes that occurred because they could build it right into the seeds. I remember being chairman of a meeting of the Toronto Society of Financial Analysts back in 1978, and the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture of that time, Jimmy Carter's secretary, was the speaker. They brought me in because I had been general manager of the Ontario Federation of Agriculture and general counsel of the Canadian Federation of Agriculture. So I sat next to him, and he gave a really fine speech. At that time, remember, grain prices had gone through the roof. We were worried about global starvation. So anyway, I said, well, look, we thank heavens for all those U.S. grain surpluses that have been built up in the 60s. So we didn't have global starvation, but what are we going to do if we have another bad year from an El Nino like we had in 73, 74, which is what sent double the price of corn? And he said, well, interesting you should say this. He said, we've had the best experts looking at it, and they've concluded that this might be the first stage sign of global cooling coming after we've had a century of strong sunspot activity and strong solar activity, in which case we might be headed in for global cooling. And he said there's already been a couple of books published about global cooling. And he said that would be disastrous for food. So he said what we're doing is we are helping to fund research in genetically modified seeds to deal with this. So I said, what's a genetically modified seed? So we explained. And he said, we're working with a company called Monsanto to develop seeds which will allow the farmers to plant earlier and to keep the crop on the field later because of protecting them against frost. So I said, you can actually do that? He said, oh, yes. So the amazing thing about it is the GM seeds which were developed originally to deal with global cooling. But, of course, Monsanto, once they got going on this, added all those other features in. So what we did was improve the crop yields. Talk about a mistake that led to an amazing outcome. So we don't have starvation in the world. Remember that when the Friends of the Earth were founded back in the 60s, they were dealing with the question of global starvation. That was their first thing. Global warming right. came after they'd solved that one. So the long answer to your question is the science, in this case, not bad governments or anything, science has given us a situation where starvation for the first time in human history is not the fate of a large percentage of the world's population. So that means that unless we actually...
I have to confess to you, Don, I'm a GMO skeptic. I'm a GMO skeptic just because of the research on what it does to the human body and what it can do.
Well, that study has to be pursued on its own because right. it has done the job it was designed to do to produce more food. So the right. question, if it does have any negative effects, that's up to another group of scientists who've got to work on it.
Right.
If that happens, then indeed we're going to have $8 corn again. That's for
right.
sure.
So what about prices? Why have the agricultural prices come down as much? You think it's because of the GMO yields?
Oh yeah, it's because the output of corn per acre in all the parts of the world where they use GMO seeds has been rising year after year after year, even years in which the weather wasn't all that good. I mean, there's no doubt about it that the GMOs did exactly what they were designed to do. As to whether or not they have negative effects on human beings, that's a totally separate question. But they did exactly what they were designed to do. And as long as you've got that, then there's an incentive for small farmers to sell out. Fortunately, what we still have left is a situation where the livestock industry is still one that can be profitable. For farmers, and
right.
We're not going to have any. I don't see anything on the horizon, which is going to lower meat prices to a level that a good pork producer or beef producer can't make a living. And
right.
one of the reasons, of course, is simply because the grain prices are so low because of GM seeds.
Right. So one of the questions I've been dying to ask you is, because you're very familiar with the pension fund industry, and one of the things that most concerns me about what's been happening in the fixed income markets and in a variety of different markets is how in the world are the pension funds going to adjust to a low interest or negative interest yield world, and how are they making this adjustment? What are they doing? And what does it mean for the pension fund industry, both in Canada and the United States?
Well, I spent 6 years on the Canada Pension Plan Advisory Committee and helped to rewrite the rules for that plan, which is the equivalent of Social Security, and it's far better funded than Social Security. But even that plan now has had to change its investment policies because of the low interest rates that we have. So the answer is that the pension funds are collectively in a state of crisis. I'm, of course, sitting in Illinois, which is the ground zero, ranking dead last among all the 50 states in terms of its public finances, and it's because of the public employee pension funds. And in this, I was talking to a group of experts on this, and they were talking about which of the big state pension funds is likely to go bankrupt first. And they said, well, the one that's actually in the worst shape in Chicago is the police fund. They got about $1.3 billion in assets and $8 billion in liabilities, except that the $8 billion in liabilities assume a very high interest rate of return. So they said that's one that's going to – but it's the teachers' funds that are the basic ones that have Illinois about $100 billion in underfunding of their public plans. So this is a something that is going to be a spread right across the nation. I believe it will become the biggest issue for the next administration of this country, assuming that it doesn't get involved in any terrible wars and we don't actually have Iran getting a nuclear weapon or something transcendental like that. So you're absolutely right, but the idea of having long-term bonds yielding 2 and 2.5%, you cannot actuarially construct, given the mortality rates we have now. It's because it's a double whammy. People are living longer, and the interest rates are a small fraction of what they were even 20 years ago. So what they needed to do was start increasing the contribution rates dramatically as soon as they saw that the interest rates were falling and were likely to stay low. No political party was prepared to level with the taxpayers on that.
Right.
So this is not a question of Democrats and Republicans, and you can blame, I mean, in Illinois, it's one-party rule, so you can blame the Democrats. But the Republicans didn't exactly cover themselves with glory by coming out and saying, do you realize how much money we have to put into it to get these plans funded? They weren't prepared to do that either.
Right.
So you've got your finger on what is the biggest single public policy challenge for the next decade, and it's the one.
Right, and I think it's part of the other thing the administration is going to face is reengineering the federal budget, and those two are related, and they're going to happen at the same time. So it's a it's an enormous, you know, it's almost like restructuring the economy from the ground up when you do it.
Well, exactly, because first of all, what you got to do is you got to say, well, you can't do what they do in Illinois, which is members of the who do the negotiating for the teachers and who haven't been in a classroom for decades. When 1 week before they retire from the bargaining committee, they go into a classroom for 1 week, and then they get allowed to get the full teacher's pension plus the union pension. You know, so those kinds of things have got to be taken away. But that's only at the edges. The fact remains that you've got, and remember that because women live longer than men, and women, this is of the professions, the one with the highest percentage of females, but they've now that we're now talking that the fastest growing population segment is the over 90s, wow. So that's going to dwarf all these other debates. And that's one that you will have to be prepared to join into to explain to your supporters how it is that they can protect themselves against the inevitable increase in state and local taxes.
Well, if you look, one way to understand this is to look at the bond market. So we've had this enormous run in the bond market with interest rates coming down and debt growing, not just here, but around the world. So it's funny, one guy at the G20 meeting sort of screamed in frustration, you know, the debt growth model is over. Well, I don't, you know, with the way we've solved our political problems in this country, and it's at federal, state, and local level, is we've just said, okay, everybody can have what they want, and we're going to increase the debt. And so now That game is up, and we've hit the limits of how much debt we can create. That's what we're saying in our conversation about negative interest rates. And so now we're going to have to turn at the state, local, and federal level and say, okay, everybody can get what they want. And you know something, all these promises we made, that's a problem too. We're going to have to reshuffle the deck. And that is something somebody hasn't heard for 30 years politically in this country.
That's right. And we're certainly not being by the candidates who are campaigning right now at the national level, none of them are talking about these gigantic problems.
Right.
They're all suggesting, well, if we can cut down with the waste in Washington, we can cut taxes. But meanwhile, the Republicans now control most of the state governments. And at those state and local levels now, they're finally starting to realize that the problems are gigantic.
And so now I have to give you another compliment. You made the single most intelligent comment on the U.S. presidential campaign so far, and I have used your quote again and again and again. So I just have to tell you what it is. The presidency of the United States is not an entry-level position. How did you ever come up with that?
Well, it came to me a year ago, and now it's now spread out there. But it's because we've all had experience with having people do this.
You run a company. You know what it's like to...
Yeah, and so therefore, you just say... How is it that the biggest job in the world is an entry-level position? And we've seen it with Obama because he never really had a job anywhere. And no doubt about it, charming, attractive, and he dealt with what had been the biggest single moral sore in the nation's record, which was the race question. So he was the right man to be elected at that time. But for him was ascribed to him a level of intelligence and experience which
that he didn't have.
Human. And so now that we see the fact that, I remember when Paul Volcker met him and he was asked what he had, what was impression about him. He said, well, he's intelligent. I thought, of course, he's the president of the United States. He's intelligent. And yet, the funny thing about it was that it's almost as if saying, isn't that a bit of a surprise? Now, not that George W. Bush was regarded as a genius, but nobody would suggest that he was stupid. So what happened, I think, with Mr. Obama was that everybody agreed he was intelligent, but then when the first book about him came out and said that he always believes he's the smartest man in the room, period. He's never been in any room that he wasn't the smartest. I thought, that's not good, because there's no way that means you can participate properly in discussions of trade-offs if you always think, if he's always the smartest man in any gathering, what he should not have done was gone into politics. He should have become a professional poker player. Because if he was always the smartest player at every table, he would become a multi-millionaire.
Well, here's the question that I've been dying to ask you. Starting in November, I started to become very concerned about how the market globally would respond to what was going on in the presidential campaign. And you would literally see, particularly the sovereign wealth funds, saying, maybe it's time to start shifting our allocations out of the United States, in part because the U.S. market's high and the emerging market's low. So it's not a bad idea to do that from an economic standpoint. But when you watch what's going on in the campaign, you literally get the feeling that the U.S. government is not under adult supervision.
Well, it is. It is worrisome. I think that the people probably that are most concerned about this are the Europeans, because they're the ones under direct threat from Putin, and they have the refugee crisis. and they have not been spending their allotted allocations, the budget, to deal with NATO. They've been living still the free ride. The idea was that once the Cold War was over, we didn't need NATO. And so now they're in a situation where not one of them, and that's one of the reasons why Obama was so annoyed at the Europeans, was that the United States was continuing to spend a lot of money on having its troops in Europe, and none of the members of the European Union were paying their budget allotments except the British and a couple of others. The others were not paying their defense costs and saying, why should we protect you from Putin if you won't put up the money yourself? So if they believe that the next president of the United States is going to be somebody who is saying, we're sick and tired of having propped up the world, and we've got our own problems now, then that's something they're really scared of, because as right. you can see, they've all got budget problems, and they've been protected by American taxpayers since Harry Truman's time, and the right. American people collectively have been willing to do that with very little complaints. And the first president to come along and say, I'm sick and tired of doing it, is Mr. Obama, for which he should be praised, because he called it like it was, which is that you're always talking about how we don't understand policies well and everything, but we are the ones who have the actual commitment, the only NATO commitment that is really protecting you. So that is, these other countries are now, if they think that the United States is turning in on itself in this election, they got to be very worried.
Right.
They had a free.
Well, part of this is the natural gas story. If we can pull back behind the Atlantic and Pacific and let the world become chaotic while we stay secure in North America, you know, things are going to look very different.
Well, with Iran getting a nuclear bomb, we can't forward to pull back, and Iran
right.
will have a nuclear bomb pretty soon. The fact that they already have ICBMs, this is amazing. Think about it.
Right.
They fired
right.
off their first ICBM within 8 days of being told that the deal was a lock. All right. Then they've done.
And had
more.
We transferred the cash then, or?
It's all being done because, as the Obama people pointed out, they said this was never part of the treaty. It was a side agreement. And the only remedy open to us in a side agreement is to have a resolution of the UN Security Council condemning them. But, of course, neither Russia nor China would join in that. So Iran is going flat out developing ICBMs. And now we're told they will be just ordinary ones with non-nuclear warheads. But it's amazing that this was done.
Right.
And so that is, I think, so the answer is we cannot go back to the idea, which was the attitude back in 1929 when the United States didn't join the Kellogg-Briand Pact, because it said we got two oceans to protect us.
Right.
And
So that brings us to our old friend, Precious Metals, so we can end on a positive note, because I know you've said recently that things look different this time. And the question for all of us, has the bottom finally been put in on precious metals?
Well, I'm going to be publishing a book on this topic, I can tell you that I believe that the number of things that have gone wrong, which almost nobody could have been predicting, against the one thing that you cannot expand the supply of. We seem to be able to expand the supply of everything else, including dumb politics. So what we have is that the supply of gold and of silver increases minutely. And therefore,
right.
The answer is that to the extent that individuals say, well, how do I protect myself when I'm worried that nobody seems to, who's in power, seems to either have the answers or is prepared to say, I have the answer, which means we've got to make the following sacrifices, all right? So in that kind of environment, then you have to look after yourself. And then you have to say, well, it used to be that the thing you could protect yourself with was government bonds. But if the United States in the next recession now, we could expect that government bond yields would go negative. Because now the fact that they're talking about it at the Fed. Yeah. So the answer is that when everything else fails, then you have to go back to the asset that was there before all those other asset classes were. And so in that sense, it's a pretty simple answer, isn't it?
Right. Right. Although I confess, I always have a debate. Franklin Sanders of the Money Changers joins us on the Salary Report a lot, and he's very opposed to the stock market. And, and yet when I'm always teasing him because I say, well, you know, you drive a Honda and you shop at Kroger and you stop at Cracker Barrel and you've got an iPhone and a laptop. And if we don't keep financing all that, you know, and you'll stop at Starbucks. And if we don't keep financing all of those things and we put all our capital in precious metals, you know, that stuff won't be there. So to me, it's a balance. You've got to put your money in things that make fundamental sense. And I do believe, Don, that the bull market in bonds is over, so that I'm not saying you can't park money in fixed income, particularly in the short and intermediate term, but I just think we're going to have to find a way to make the equity of the planet make sense and stop bubbling it up with government money and get back to fundamentals. I don't see any other way around it.
Well, it's certainly true that the negative yielding bonds were a full frontal attack on what was the basic way in which we measured risk and how we saved for it, which is the capital asset pricing model.
Right.
And the capital asset pricing model is behind every pension fund, every serious pension fund that you know of. And this is a full front attack on the capital asset pricing model, because when you once have negative yielding bonds, then the rest of the model doesn't work. And the actuaries who've been around for centuries, God bless them, the actuaries are now confronted with an asset class which is supposedly the one risk-free asset class from which everything else is priced, namely government bonds.
Right.
Now we're told the government bonds will have negative yields. So what does that do to what you have to do then with the rest of the construction of your models? And I don't have an answer for the actuaries on that, nor do you. But what I do know is that when the actuaries no longer can construct a model, we got problems.
Right. Well, that's why, you know, it's another way of saying we're coming into a pretty large reinvention of everything. So if you have to reinvent the U.S. budget and you have to reinvent the pension funds, and I guess one of my concerns in that is if you look at how much governmental entities are buying in terms of equities and bonds. If the central banks keep doing what they're doing, we're going to end up with a sovereign wealth funds, a variety of different governmentally controlled pension funds, and the central banks essentially having bought up the world by printing money.
It's a melancholy thought. So rather than do that, I think that you must retain the point that at some point what will happen is the governments will not just do something wrong, but they'll actually do it right, and along the way they'll also find a way of injecting humor into the solutions.
Right.
Although
I think, yeah, when in the 90s, my company in Washington was working on, we were making software tools that both as a portfolio strategist and then for communities would allow us to look at the federal budget by place. And what we discovered was, and we're working with a wonderful group of pension fund leaders, just fabulous guys. What we discovered is if you said, okay, we're just going to re-engineer federal credit and appropriations and other investment for, and we're going to optimize return on the to taxpayer as opposed to political considerations, you could get enormous explosion in wealth. You know, the sub-optimization was so severe. And then if you add in all the new technology that's happened, there's explosive wealth creation that could happen. So, you know, so I'm not a pessimist. It's just we're going to have to start allocating resources according to economic fundamentals as opposed to politics. And essentially, if you look at the U.S. federal budget, what we've been trying to do is centralize control and layer on enormous amounts of complex regulation, which are very, create enormous and unnecessary labor. So between the complexity, the unnecessary complexity and the centralization, you know, you're doing a lot through the federal budget to destroy the economy. I once had the senior service executives at HUD say, what could we most do to help the economy? And I said, shut the agency down. If you shut the agency down, you know, the economies would blossom.
There's no question about it that the level, I mean, the when Dodd-Frank gets to 32,000 pages of regulations,
right?
Think about it. So when the head of the largest bank says that they have hired 750 experts whose only job is to go through the regulations on Dodd-Frank and see that the J.P. Morgan doesn't violate them. Now, admittedly, the performance of J.P. Morgan and the Wall Street banks leading up to the crash was terrible. But the point is that now what they're doing is basically expanding this, and they're expanding it to regional banks even, not the kind that caused the crash. Because Elizabeth Warren said bankers are bad. Okay, so we've gone from saying that a few big Wall Street banks were bad to saying that bankers are bad, and the only protection against us is to have civil servants in Washington who will keep drafting new regulations.
Right.
32,000. I mean, it is in that sense. It bears comparison with the pyramids. The only difference with the pyramids is that they lasted, but the amount of effort was off the scale.
Well, I will say this. I live in Tennessee, and if you look at the farms that were put out of business by food safety rules and government regulation, same as the coal industry, they weren't put out of business by the market. Even at these commodity prices, they could be making money. But literally, the food safety rules, the regulations, the laws have put them out of business. So this was a regulatory decision to centralize, a political decision to centralize, had nothing to do with the market.
Jeez. Well, it is sad. And the thing about it is we're not dealing with evil people. Okay, those civil servants who come to work are told that they are doing what is national public policy, and that they are what they're doing is a good thing, and they're so to say that the best hope you have of them is that they will be lazy, feckless, and not do their jobs. That is pointing out where the real blame is. Then is with the politicians that have drafted out these regulations and told their people to do these kinds of things. So, yeah. In that sense,
well, I would say it this way, because I think you
effective.
Yeah, I think you can make it pretty simple, and that is, you know, the Western world for 500 years has been on the central banking war. I call it, or James Turk originally called it the central banking warfare model, and now I've poached that. But, you know, you've had a dynamic where, for a variety of reasons related to the financial system and globalization, we've been centralizing. The federal budget has contributed to that. Now we're going to have to shift it because we have to dramatically increase productivity. Because I think one of the chief causes of the deflation we're dealing with is that productivity's flatlined. So, and all the things we've been talking about today contribute to that. So, I think if you were to switch fundamentally to much higher, you know, I believe in markets. If we could only allow markets to happen, as an American, I say the Soviet Union run the war because we've gone to centralized economies here in the United States, and I don't think it's working. So that's my prejudice.
Well, I don't think it's a prejudice. It's that it's. So all we can do is try to protect ourselves and our families and also give good advice to those who believe that we have something useful to say.
Right.
That's the only opportunities vouchsafed to us at a time when so many things are going wrong.
And, so I'm very excited that you're writing a book. So tell us, before we close, tell us how we can sign up to be notified that book's ready. I can't wait.
The time that this book comes out, I've just started working on it because I've concluded that the time has come for a discussion of gold against all these new kinds of challenges. So you say, well, parts of gold books on gold that are out there. Well, I've been going over the ones that are there. And frankly, they deal with a world where the challenges were different than the ones we're facing now. So I expect that this will therefore be the one that will provide the most help to people for the world that you and I have just been discussing in the last hour, which is, remember, a world unlike any one that we have lived through.
Right. Right. And tell us, Don, how we can access your website and your podcasts.
The our website is coxadvisors.com, and it's COXE, and we'd be glad to certainly have communication with clients of yours, because obviously you and I are simpatico creatures. Doesn't mean we agree on everything. That would be boring. But on the other hand, what we have is a proper respect for the threats that are out there.
Yeah.
The people most dangerous are those who refuse to admit the seriousness of the challenges.
Right.
You are a serious person with a sense of humor. It helps. But
yes.
You have to be serious first. What we are now have is politicians who are unserious. That's dangerous. So on that note, what I'll tell you is we will see that you are given full notification when the book is ready for publication.
Okay.
Because that's one that would probably delight a significant percentage of your followers.
It's the Solari Network's going to love your book.
I wish there were more like you in the world.
Well, I think it's from what I've seen from what we're doing, it's growing. More and more people really want to know what's going on and to make sense of it. So, You know, I don't know if you want to work hard for another 20 years, but you're going to have the opportunity.
Bless you.
Okay, well, Don Cox, thank you for joining us on A Celery Report. You have a marvelous day.
And to you. Bye-bye.